Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. On June 29th, Washington Post Live hosted a series of conversations on health equity, particularly the toll of racial inequality on access to health care. I kick things off with Dr. Rachel Levine, Assistant Secretary for Health for the Department of Health and Human Services. We discussed all the interlocking issues that lead to disparate health outcomes in Black and brown communities, from transportation to climate to stigma. Also, Admiral Levine is the highest-ranking out transgender government official in U.S. history. So I got her thoughts on the rash of anti-LGBTQ plus bills and laws propping up around the country. And she explains why, even though this is the end of Pride Month,
this should be a summer of pride. We should have pride all summer.
Let's begin with the recent study of death certificates from the last two decades, which found that a higher mortality rate among African Americans resulted in more than 1.6 million premature deaths compared to the white population. How do you explain this?
Well, this is a very important study published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which highlights the significant health disparities that exist in our nation, which impact life expectancy, particularly with African Americans versus other groups. This further confirms the information that we know at the Department of Health and Human Services about how significant these health disparities are, and it shows how far we have to go to achieve health equity.
Well, I mean, I'm glad you bring that up, because 40 years ago, Margaret Heckler, who was President Reagan's health secretary, wrote a report that outlined the disparate health outcomes on Black and minority health. And as you bring up, the problem has only gotten worse. Is it due to health disparities, or the quality of care, or a combination of the two, or even more factors?
I think that it is those two factors, and there are even more factors. One of the most significant issues is lack of access to care for many in the African American community, and that can be in urban areas and in rural areas. It has to do with lack of health insurance, but also I think the social determinants of health, those social factors that influence health, that we don't usually consider health related: economic opportunity, educational opportunity, nutrition, the environment, transportation, housing, and more. All of those factors together, I think, influence these statistics.
How about stigma?
Absolutely. I mean, so structural and systemic racism and stigma have a big influence on this. And these are all issues that we are working to address at the Department of Health and Human Services under Secretary Becerra's leadership, and of course, throughout the Biden-Harris administration.
This was an audience question I was going to bring up later, but it's perfect to bring up now. It's an audience question from Lynn Filiatro. I know I butchered Lynn's last name. I'm so sorry. From Washington, you can see it on the screen behind me. Do you agree that health inequity is a systemic issue? If so, what systemic changes do you believe are necessary, to remove the health disparity across racial groups, age groups, and social classes?
So I do think it is a systemic issue. Certainly the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us the depth and breadth of the health disparities in our nation and the lack of health equity. That is why the president started the COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force, which was run through my office and I was honored to have a seat on, which looked at many of these issues that were being brought forth by the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the different aspects of it. And so really, health equity is fundamental to everything that we're doing now at HHS under Secretary Javier Becerra's leadership. It is foundational. And so when we look at every grant, we look at every notice of funding, we look at every regulation, we look at every topic that we're researching and that we're trying to work on, health equity is central to it. We have a health disparities task force, which I'm very pleased to co-chair, and many different activities, both at my office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, CMS, HRSA, CDC, NIH, and more.
And I brought up I used the word stigma because sitting in that seat a few months ago was Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, who is the Deputy White House Coordinator for the MPOX response. And he talked about many of the things you're mentioning, but also stigma and how that is playing into a lot of the health disparities we see in the country, but also people's access to HIV treatment, to the Mpox vaccine. I'm sure a lot of people in this room understand and know what you're talking about intuitively, but maybe for folks who are watching virtually, talk about why all of these things why transportation and quality of healthcare, how all those things are intertwined.
Sure. Well, stigma is critical, and we see that stigma in terms of the LGBTQI plus community. And in some ways, in many states in this country, that has gotten worse. But in terms of transportation, so I was in East St. Louis last week. I was in St. Louis and then went just across the river to East St. Louis in Illinois and saw significant environmental justice challenges, saw significant issues in terms of availability of nutrition, availability of fruits and vegetables in that area, saw challenges in terms of access to health care. One of it is there's very little public transportation and many people don't have cars. So if they're going to go see their doctor or their nurse practitioner, how are they going to do that? If you open a store in one part of East St. Louis with fresh fruits and vegetables, how do people on the other side get there? And so transportation is absolutely critical for access to health care and access to nutrition, to health, education, all of those factors.
So which community, you talked about going into East St. Louis.
That's correct.
Which communities are most at risk of not receiving quality health care? Is it specifically communities of color, or does it cut across racial lines?
Both. So absolutely, communities of color face enormous challenges in terms of health equity. And that includes the Black African-American community we've been discussing, but also the Latino community and the American Indian Native Alaskan community, which also significantly has these challenges. But we see cross-cutting issues in specific urban areas. We have food deserts in urban areas mm-hmm. where you can get food, but it's going to be fast food and unhealthy fast food, but you can't get fresh produce in many urban areas. We see that in even suburban areas and then certainly in rural areas. Lack of housing, lack of transportation, problems in terms of education. So it is specifically for communities of color, but it is also cross-cutting in terms of other parameters.
So then what are some of the interventions or programs that the government has put in place or wants to put in place that would reduce racial disparities? And those programs that are in place, which are the successful ones? What are they
sure.
doing?
Well, one of the most successful programs is through HRSA, the Health Resources Service Administration. Those are our community health centers. Mm-hmm. We have many, many, thousand or more community health centers across the country. They are located in urban areas. They're located in rural areas. And they're located so people can access them, and they often have transportation to them to provide access to that care. In terms of the Affordable Care Act and expansion of Medicaid, that through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that is a critical component to accessing health care and having health insurance, except there are still a number of states that haven't expanded Medicaid, even after all this time. CMS is concentrating on many, many different factors in terms of health equity. Within our Office of Minority Health and Women's Health, in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, we have many different programs focusing on this, including the issue of maternal mortality. Mm-hmm. Maternal mortality. Women who are sick or with morbidity or mortality might die during pregnancy or during delivery or within a year afterwards. The United States is the only developed country that has an increasing rate of maternal mortality, and it is almost exclusively in the Black African American community. These are issues that all of our different divisions within HHS are looking at, being studied by CDC and NIH, and then being addressed by HRSA, CMS, and more.
Just, what was it, last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, front page of the Washington Post, story about Black maternal health and just the increasing numbers of Black women dying
in childbirth or after childbirth.
I had a conversation with a member of Congress where I brought this up, and she said every 3 months or so, or every quarter, there seems to be three stories in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, all talking about this issue.
Yes.
Each time there's a story, it only highlights how much worse it's gotten since the last story, but no conversations about what can be done to make things better. So what can be done to make things better so that the next front page story in the Washington Post about Black maternal health will not be it's gotten worse, but we're starting to see a decline in the rate of
absolutely
death.
Well, first we need to study it intently, and the CDC has been doing that. So they have been sponsoring maternal health morbidity review committees, which when I was in Pennsylvania we started one, as well as perinatal collaboratives to look at different factors within each state that can address those state specific issues. But we also need, a lot of it is access to prenatal care, also with the different social factors that we've been discussing. It's making sure that the pregnant women have insurance, and it's making sure that they have proper nutrition, all of those different factors. But we have programs, again, through my office, through HRSA, and really CMS and more, looking to address that. And I think with this attention in the Biden-Harris administration and this dedication under Secretary Becerra's leadership, we're going to make progress, but it's going to take some time. Mm-hmm.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom, and you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk a little bit more about COVID-19, because that really highlighted, I mean, I'm sure you knew about this, but it really highlighted for the country the health disparities that persist in the United States. What lessons did you learn from that experience?
I think we learned a number of different lessons. One of the lessons is the critical importance of public health. Public health right now is the center of the universe, and it's so important that we invest in public health, that we invest in the workforce, we invest in the information technology and the data for public health. And I think sustainable funding for public health now and in the future is critically important as we continue to work through the COVID-19 and long COVID, as well as prepare for the next pandemic. The second is how critically important it is for local, state, federal, and international public health authorities to work together. And I think that we have made a lot of progress with that in the Biden-Harris administration. Working with state health officials, I was a state health official during the first year of COVID, with our local health officials, and we have had many discussions, first online and now in person, with our colleagues in the states and the local governments to make sure that we're in sync. And the other is those social determinants of health, is that you can't just look at medical care in isolation. Really, we have to look at these other social factors that influence health. So to me, you know, the work done in the Department of Commerce is a health issue. The work done by Secretary Pete in the Department of Transportation, that's a health issue. Housing at HUD, those are all health issues. And so we have to work with those to deal with the current challenges, such as maternal mortality, such as the continued opioid overdose crisis, and many of the other challenges that we face today.
Let me, as you mentioned, you were a former state official, but you were formerly a pediatrician focused on child and adolescent behavioral health.
Yes.
What impact do you think COVID has had when it comes to the mental health of America's children?
Well, you know, we see many different studies. The newest one is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey out of the CDC that indicate the challenges to mental health among our youth. A lot of that started before the pandemic, but has clearly been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's why our Surgeon General, Vice Admiral Vivek Murthy, issued a report and highlighting this in December of 2021. And we have many different programs and all the different same departments and divisions we've been discussing, including, of course, SAMHSA, the Substance Use Mental Health Service Administration, looking at youth mental health and trying to address that.
You're the highest ranking out transgender government official in U.S. history. You and I were both at Vice President Harris's Pride Month reception at the Vice President's residence last night. And in her remarks, she decried the 500 plus bills that have been introduced in legislatures across the country. More than 70 of them have become law. There have been challenges, to be sure. Just yesterday, federal judges in Kentucky and Tennessee, they blocked bans on gender-affirming care for minors in those states. I would love your thoughts on the impact of these bills and laws popping up across the country.
Well, it is very challenging for health equity for the LGBTQI plus community, and these politically and ideologically motivated laws and actions are harming youth, particularly transgender youth, their families, and even their providers who are under siege in many parts of this country. And they're really interfering with the relationship between expert physicians, for instance, at children's hospitals, these young people, and their families. And it's not where government belongs.
Personally, excuse me, as an out transgender person, I'm not going to say as government official, though I don't want to get you in trouble. But personally, what do you make of the tenor and tone of the conversation that we're having in this country when it comes to LGBTQIA plus issues?
Well, you know, again, the challenge has been these regressive laws and actions that have been promulgated throughout the country. Again, being done specifically for political and ideological purposes. But I see a change. I think things are changing. I think that since Transgender Day of Visibility and now the momentum we've developed at Pride, I think that the conversation is changing. I think the narrative is changing, focusing on these vulnerable youth and their families and their doctors. And I think with Pride Month just finishing up this week, that we are going to continue to change that narrative and continue to make progress. That's why I've said this should be a summer of Pride. We should have Pride all summer, which means that we need to continue these discussions. We need to continue to change the narrative about health equity and about families and about these young people, so that we can get past this very challenging stage and continue the progress that we have been making before.
And in your travels around the country, is that what's driving what seems this optimism from you about a summer of Pride, that there is pushback around the country to the overall rhetoric and tone and tenor
That's exactly right. So at the same time, I see these young people and their families, and I meet their doctors who are having such struggles, but I sense a change. I sense a positive change that I think is going to continue despite the challenges that we face, and I think that's going to lead for the tide to turn. And I think that these laws and actions will not stand, and I think that we will continue to make progress. Now, I'm a positive and optimistic person because I choose to be positive and optimistic. But under the Biden-Harris administration and the leadership shown at the highest levels of government and across the administration for the LGBTQI plus community and the actions in states and in communities, changing hearts and minds, I remain positive.
So I noticed you wouldn't get personal in that answer. So I'm going to ask you something else. Maybe you'll go personal on this. The last, and this is a total diversion, but the last show you binged.
So I don't get to watch a lot of TV, as you might imagine. with a schedule that I keep. But between the time that I was nominated and then confirmed and started my position, I actually binge watched Madam Secretary to get a feel of what Washington was like.
Seriously?
Absolutely.
Madam Secretary. And so then what lessons did you learn?
I learned that Washington can be an interesting place and with many opportunities and many challenges. I learned a little bit about how different departments, of course, that was Department of State and I'm Department of HHS, interactions with the White House, interactions with the press. And of course, it's a TV show and it's right. You know, made in Hollywood and it has a certain perspective. I mean, amazing challenges were solved in one or two episodes. It takes a little longer to solve these problems. But if you look at many of the issues that were discussed in that show, they are ripped from the headlines. Mm-hmm. Environmental challenges. We haven't talked about climate change and health equity. Look outside today in terms of the air quality that we have in the East Coast and in much of the Midwest. They discussed that. They discussed a potential war between Ukraine and Russia in that show. They discussed issues of health, issues in terms of economic opportunity. So many different issues that the opioid crisis and more that we see right now were shown in that show. So even though it's a TV show, it was valuable.
What did you pick up from Madam Secretary that got completely obliterated by the reality of the job?
Well, that she had like four or five staff that basically, you know, helped run her entire life at the Department of State. I have more staff than the Madam Secretary had. But you know, some important nuggets, some lessons learned from the show. So
I find it curious, Madam. You binge watch Madam Secretary, which is great, but not House of. I mean, House of Cards.
I deferred on that. I never watched it, so I can't tell you exactly. But what I heard, it had a much darker tone, subtle. But that's what I've been told.
Right.
Madam Secretary had a very positive and optimistic tone. I've told you, I'm a positive and optimistic person, and I think that. In this administration, with the leadership that we have, that we're making changes to benefit health equity and many other challenges that we have in the United States and across the world. And so I wanted a positive show, not a show that would be show me what I was getting into in Washington.
Admiral Rachel Levine, Assistant Secretary for Health at the Department of Health and Human Services, thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to KPART. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan Capehart. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the year is here. It's Way Day. Right now, you can score up to 80% off at Wayfair. Save on sofas and cookware, dining sets and rugs and beds, wall art, bar cards, floor lamps, ceiling fans, home decor, all things outdoor, and way more. All up to 80% off right now. Plus, everything ships free. And flash deals are launching all Way Day long. Don't miss Wayfair's biggest sale of the year. Shop Way Day right now, May 6th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.